Welcome back to Alaska Voices. Today we'll be sharing a number of conversations that focus on the theme of uneven ground, life in changing communities. Alaskans are among the first to experience the far-reaching impacts of climate change, but the region has also experienced rapid societal change over several generations. We must understand how these impacts can compound and manifest in everyday life before moving forward.
I sat down with Melinda Chase on the banks of the Tanana River to get her perspectives and thoughts on the conversations we share today.
So I'm Melinda Chase, and I am here today in my role as the tribal liaison at the Alaska Climate Adaptation Science Center. In my role, it's really to assist tribes sort of as a connector to the science, and how do you apply that for decision-making, particularly with what we see is coming down the pipe, the significant amount of change. I'm born and raised here in Alaska. My father is from Anvik, which is my home village. I keep pretty close ties there, go home quite often. This area that we're in right now is the traditional territory of the lower Dene people on the Tanana River. And Dene is the word that's used for, that means the people, and it really covers what other people would know as the Athabaskan Nation across both Alaska and Canada. Mm-hmm. We're actually recording in the site that eventually became the non-native or white village of Chena here at the Chena Pump Campground. And the old village is downriver near Howard Luke's Galea Camp. That was the native village in the area, and it's actually, he's got a old graveyard over there. The people of this area were the original stewards, and still are very much the stewards of this land, even though we've been impacted by contact and colonization, and in recognizing histories, we're also recognizing the contributions of the people in terms of just keeping this land alive, both with the animals and the fish and the abundance we had during a certain era when that was under more of our use.
I spent several hours at the Pioneer Home and recorded with some of the residents. In our society, we often don't listen to the people that hold our history. For this next conversation, we'll hear from Helen Peters and Stacy Brabend. Stacy is a master's student in the counseling program at UAF and is recording with Helen, who is a resident at the Pioneer Home. We don't hear much from Stacy, but she is present and holding space for Helen as she shares her voice. Helen has a warm and bright way about her, and it's easy to get lost in her stories. I recorded the following conversation titled Caring for Elders as a 14-year-old Nurse that Kelsey Skonberg produced.
My name is Stacy Brabend. I'm 30 years old.
I'm Helen S. Peters. I was born 1929. I'm 88 years old. I've had 7 children, and I adopted 2 girls. Together, I have 9 children, and I have about 30 grandchildren. Am I going to start?
Yes.
Okay. I come from a big family. I was the last of my family. My mother died with baby birth after me. When I was a little girl, I remember it was 50, 60, 70 below. But we were dressed for it. We had fur boots, fur parkas, everything, and we'd slide down. Imagine, 60 below and we're sliding down. And I never knew unhappiness because my father was very active person, and he trapped and took care of all of us, and as a mother and a father, he was such a person that never gives you a chance to feel bad or anything, because he was a dancer and he was a singer, and that's what he did. He was a believer and a creator. As long as he was alive, there was always peace in the house. Until 1942, the day the great flood came and he drowned it right after my 14th birthday. I miss my father so much, like the whole world has ended. 1942, an epidemic hit that little village, and I saw a bunch of little babies in coffins. Even men and women died at that time. My godmother was a deaconess there, and she used to come to our house and tell me, "Could you help me?" So I go and help her to go to the houses and feed the little babies and bathe them. I don't know how I ever got sick, but she had gowns, you know, protecting gloves and things like that. And then when things cleared up, I thought to myself, what could I do at my age? My grandmother is 100 years old, and everybody is gone, and what could I do? It's 3 miles to the town, and I walk right to the hospital. We only had a head nurse and not a doctor, and she came and she asked me what I was doing. And I tell her, I'm looking for a job. At the age of 14, she wrote down my name, and then she said, "You know what? You came just in time." She said, "We're short of nurses." What my grandmother did for me was to teach me. And then when I went to work, they were amazed at what I can do. Elders always were glad for me to take care of them because I took care of an elder. So I knew. And when she got sick, the nurse told me, "Go up and take care of her." They brought me everything from the hospital to take care of her. At that time, women and men used to be ready for death. They get their clothes all ready and have it in a suitcase or something. And one day she said, "I want grouse." So I sent somebody out on grouse. She ate that and she told me, "Wash my hair." So I washed her hair, gave her a bed bath, put clean nightgown on her. Evening came, and then she went to sleep. She was holding my hand, and I went to sleep. I woke up at midnight, and she had gone already. And that was the way we parted, both her and I. Then I went back to work. And then 1970, Episcopal bishop called my husband. He was working, helping build a hospital in Nome or someplace. And I was working at home. The bishop called him and tell him, "I'm taking your family to Phoenix." And so he asked him, "What for?" He says, "I'm looking for ministers. I'm going to train you and your wife." When my husband came back, we talked about it. Finally, he said, "Let's take a try. Let's gamble." It was hot. Very hot. And I tell him, "I don't think I'll stay here in the summer." He say, "Neither do I. We'll have to go back Alaska in the summertime." But not knowing what's going to be, my husband got cancer in the brain. Well, that was his idea. He's going to be the priest, not me. But it turned around, and I became the priest. I was ordained deacon in 74. I was ordained priest in 05. Because I come from that line of priests, my relatives were all priests. And this song was made for kids, children, my grandchildren. "You, my grandchildren, dance. You, my grandchildren, sing. You, my grandchildren, play." I'll sing it? Okay. "Hee-haw, hee-haw, hey. ho, hee ho, hee ho, oh, hee yo, hee, se cho, ya ka, hee ho, hee yo, hee, hee ho, hee ho, hee ho, oh, hee yo, hee, jow, le, ze, hee ho, hee yo, hee, hee ho, hee ho, hee ho, oh, hee yo, hee, jow, le, ze, hee ho, hee yo, hee, hee ho, hee ho, hee ho, oh, hee yo, hee. He's a choyaka. Hee ho, hee yo, hee. Hee ho, hee ho, hee ho, oh, hee yo, hee. Dark Naton, that is it.
I saw you nod your head a number of times and go, hmm, and take notes. I'm wondering what sort of things went through your head.
Well, when we hear our elders, particularly elders that are in the age and have gone through the life experience that Helen has gone through, and I think listening to them and just hearing their voice and their cadence and the way they talk is reassuring. And Helen herself in particular is just such a kind person, always, always welcoming. And she has children that way as mm-hmm. well.
So you know Helen?
Oh, yeah. I've met Helen. And okay. I know three of her children who've involved in different levels of leadership, both in their village and in the region. So Tanana has always been a place in my mind that has been significant, in part mostly because my mother, who's originally from California, came up in 58, 59. It was right around statehood. She had just finished nurse's school, schooling in Northern California. And so Tanana has a pretty rich history. And part of that history is the hospital that was based there before it, you know, got moved to Fairbanks. I think one of the things that really struck me in terms of the theme that ran through the recording is preparedness. It was shown in many ways, right? I think in particular to the way she talked about her grandmother teaching her, you know, training her to be able to manage on her own. And, you know, and part of it, having lost her dad, I mean, lost her mom at birth
yeah.
and then having a father that clearly guided her in a positive way. And I think that comes through in her personality, but also a grandmother that demonstrated and, you know, helped her learn how to work and take care of her. Most of our elders did prepare for death. I fortunately have seen that. I've seen that with a great aunt who had everything lined up, you know, in terms of what she was going to be buried in or put away. And in that sense, it's really what happens when you prepare yourself and prepare other people around you and have your items prepared. It's really an honor. You are taking care of preparing for your death and preparing other people and to ease through that time. Even in thinking about the song that she shared and thinking about the significance of celebrating your children and a song to tell your children to dance and play and sing. And clearly that was something that she learned from her father. But if you think about the theme, the intent of Alaska Voices, the intent of this series, you know, the theme of building tomorrow for Alaska. And that particularly in times of stress that we're in, whether it's, you know, the onset of a pandemic, which clearly she experienced, right? Mm-hmm. To not have a pandemic or an epidemic hit us in a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And then thinking about potential abrupt disruptions, right? And what is it that would keep you connected, help you to prepare for those times?
D- The next conversation we will share is a good example of why we started the Alaska Voices Project, listening to others' perspectives and building bridges to those perspectives.
Orville and Wilson talk about their cultures and their relationship with storytelling. It feels strange to boil it down to just this statement, because their conversation is a lot more than that. I recorded the following conversation titled Storytelling as a Conduit of Culture at the Alaska Forum on the Environment that Kelsey Skonberg produced.
I'm Orville Huntington. I don't know who my partner is, but I'm not related to them, whoever they are.
Wilson, Justin. All my partners are friends and compatriots and clan relatives. Want me to start?
Yeah, you could go ahead.
Storytelling in our Atna region is foundational. It's our school. You learn everything you need to know through stories.
Yeah.
Everywhere you need to go through stories, and everything that you need to interact with other people through storytelling. Is that how your background is?
It's similar. When we're younger, we just listen. And then, like right now, I'm learning from you. I'm a little bit younger.
When I was growing up, the storytellers would talk to each other to make sure they have the story right. If you were lucky enough to be close by, you can listen, but you can't make noise. You're in the background.
I can remember a lot of times they expected us to remember certain events, like 1939 when the salmon were so plentiful you could walk across the river on them. And I try to figure in my mind as a scientist how much that was, and I come up to somewhere around 1 million king salmon and probably no number on chum salmon, too many. I remember that date for them since they work so hard. Remember that one time.
When I first heard these stories, they were all in our language, you know, just Athabaskan, Atna, no English. And as I began to have this English come into my life, by the time I was 8, 9, 10 years of age, it started to create a lot of confusion. A lot of the terminology didn't match.
A lot of times when they told me in broken English, I misinterpret what they meant. So a lot of this stuff sounded funny, but really it was the way they were telling it. It was supposed to be told in Athabaskan.
I was only allowed to basically ask a question once, because they expected my memory to work like their memory. Their memory is infallible. They remember things 30 years ago, 40 years ago, on a wide range. And I can remember linearly stuff that I did, but not what other people did, which is what our elders could remember. You talk about cousins and relatives doing things in other places. And since our existence is glued together by stories and songs and language, all of our laws and everything, I have a certain way of looking at stories that the next generation won't be able to accommodate.
Right. A lot of the young ones, they don't know Athabaskan anymore, so you have to get it as close as you can in English.
One of the things that English doesn't adequately capture in reference to the indigenous storytelling context is the importance, the enormous importance of the stories by itself. We consider stories to be alive, and they're a neighbor, a friend, a protector. When I hear a story, it's like being at a neighbor's table or a friend's table having supper or something. And you don't get a sense of that in any place in the scientific literature. I don't know how long you've been on meetings and boards, but that's pretty tough to sit there and read that.
It's tough to listen to, and then just talking to you this short time, you're way more knowledge than any PhD that I sat down with the last 20 years. Just the way you tell the story and what you remember. Yeah, your people in the Upper Tanana, they saved a lot of culture. You guys saved Yukon area, Southeast area. And then I know some of those stories and songs and stuff you guys held on for a long time before you gave them back. And we did that a little bit on the Kaikuk because we go over Kobuk River all the time, but it was a different language. So my grandmother got used to speaking in Inupiaq, even though it wasn't our people. They wanted us to kind of save some of their story because there was a lot of people coming in
They weren't allowed to speak their language or nothing. We weren't able to save the songs, but a lot of the stories we saved for them.
We had the what they call the old-time chief talk, which was used in Potlatch oratory. So if a chief went down to Nenana and used that language, a lot of what he said would be understood. If I went down there and my mom spoke, they would have a hard time following it because that would be a very local clan dialect. Our trade language used by a medicine man was a multicultural, kind of a mixture of all the different languages and words along the trail.
The medicine man or that person was really criticized by religion that they brought with them. So they really knew a lot about language and how to heal people. And I remember my aunt in her 80s, she remembered all the kadazidni and all the other things that went with medicine. And so her and I started sing in our language at Potlatch, and she get mad at herself because she couldn't remember the words, but yet she had all that knowledge. It's like a library of knowledge, and she was like you. She's just a PhD in the way she was raised.
Most of the Euro-Western system that we have to contend with, they don't really look at storytelling like we do. They look at storytelling as, you know, something fun. When you gift or leave or store a story with another tribe, it's almost the same as offering your life. It's that serious.
I really am grateful for you sharing with me today. It helped heal me inside because in a lot of these science meetings, I get beat up pretty bad. So it's hurtful with some of the stuff that they say, and they don't mean to. They just don't know. And so for me to sit here and learn a little bit about what it was in your country and the way you grew up there with your elders, I can see why they gave you that to share.
Well, thank you. A lot of times over the decades, you end up in Western meetings and Western stuff, and you get treated with contempt, and you get treated with dismissive. They say stuff like, you know, it's anecdotal. And I just kept plugging away. I just kept going and going. And so it's really a pleasure for me to be able to have like-minded people in the conversation.
I was going to do this with somebody, and I thought, no, I got to, if I'm going to tell about how we tell stories, it's got to be with somebody that grew up like me. It can't be somebody else. So that's why I look for you all over till I found you.
Yeah, I certainly appreciate it.
You're a doctor in your own right. And
thank you.
In your own way for your own people. For me, I'm not there yet. I'm a little bit too young to say anything.
You'll get there. It took me a while.
No, you're there. Your people put you there for a reason. I know those people. I knew some of them. They're gone now. Yeah, good people.
Yeah.
This recording had, you know, many, many things that you could pick up on, in particular the significance of stories in our cultures. My great-grandmother was a storyteller from Holikachuk who moved to Anvik. And I did not grow up with that kind of centering on stories as much. I think in extended families, I would hear stories in my own household. I got reflections from my father, and I come from a mixed household, so I think that the sharing was different. But I think about my grandmother, because I spent quite a bit of time with a great aunt who taught a lot of the young women in my age group to sew. And she reflected on her mom and her, they called her old grandma, and they would sew at night. And she said, you know, we would sit down and we would be sewing or working on hand projects. She said, and she would share, they would share, you know, sometimes for hours. And she said, it's just like a TV in our mind, you know. When both Orville and Wilson talked about that not necessarily being valued, and then, you know, looking at like the science community or this project waking up to the significance of stories,
yeah.
Right? In part to be able to convey what our lived experience is, right? And when you think about climate communication, certain concepts that are being studied and researched, and yet the language that is used in science can be very non-accessible. How do we honor stories, not just for story's sake, but again, in that role of helping to prepare us, right? Helping to bridge our experience. And then also realizing that they have a significant space and consciously not discounting them.
Or unconsciously.
Or unconsciously, yeah, yeah, dismissing them. And so I think that if they are something that's helped guide us over time and stick with us, then they do help prepare us. A lot of us have heard this in Native communities that our elders talked about, that things could get rough again, times can get hard again, and, you know, to be prepared and to learn, particularly learn some of our own knowledge and our own skills and our own way of life, and to perpetuate that. That may seem like a minor thing, but it's not, you know. And yet, it's not like clear cut systematic evidence.
Yeah, right, yeah, right, right.
It's interesting because we're on the Tanana River, and you know, Howard Luke, he would carry a walking stick with him, and like in Gwich'in language, it's called toh. But I remember seeing elders, you know, always having that stick, and it has, you know, multiple uses, but particularly for safety issues, right? And so he used to walk back and forth. He went through the ice, I should say, well, not one under, but he went through the ice, and it was that stick that saved him,
oh,
you know, that yeah. allowed him to recover. And, you know, and I often think about that being on this river mm-hmm. quite a bit, right? Our elders often will tell a story or they will say something, and it may be really, really subtle. And, you know, part of it is like what Wilson said, are you listening? You know, what is your role as a listener and a learner and a keeper? And then applying it.
Yeah, yeah.
And some of that may take risk in applying it. You know, it may require you to stop and say, well, wait a second, maybe I need to do this differently because I heard that story and that story was given to me to guide me. And so being very conscious about applying it to yourself.
As we were wrapping up at the Alaska Forum on the Environment, Victor came to us and told us he really wanted to share and document his story. Victor talks about the changes he is observing in his community and how those changes are impacting his culture and way of life. This also highlights the importance of sharing knowledge through storytelling.
Bob Bolton recorded the following conversation titled Braving Thin Ice that Kelsey Skonberg produced.
My name is Victor Tunutsuk Jr. I'm 31 years old and I'm speaking with Ryan.
And my name is Ryan Tui. I am 40 years old. And I'm speaking with Victor, a friend and collaborator. Can you tell people what Kotlik's like and where it's at?
Kotlik is located on the north mouth of the Yukon Delta. It's a Yupik Eskimo community in rural Alaska. We are a community that still practice and rely on a subsistence and fishing lifestyle.
So you guys are like right on the edge of Alaska and staring off into the Bering Sea there, and a lot of the stuff that comes to Kotlik comes in by barge, right?
Yes,
yeah.
Barge and by plane.
So that's one of the reasons that the fish and the moose are important.
Yes.
Did you have a particular story that you wanted to
tell? Yeah, my late father, Victor Tunutsuk Sr., he talked to me about the changes from when he was a child, from his last days on Earth in... Wow. Kotlik. We lived there our whole lives, probably 5 to 8 generation. One of the things that he shared with me was sea level rise. He mentioned that Kotlik never really used to experience flooding. We had river ice jams. Storms weren't really an issue back then. I'd say within the last 20 years, maybe about 15 of those years, we've seen a lot of changes in our climate with floods, erosions. The fall storms are a lot intense.
You guys had a pretty substantial flood, was it 3 or 4 years ago?
Yes, it was in November of 2013. I think it was like a 15-mile radius of how far the water and ice came in. So we're about 5 miles up the river from the ocean. Some of our lakes are drying out. Places where swamp, they're drying out. In the past, our freeze-ups would occur in like the middle part of October. But nowadays, we're starting to see our freeze-ups like during November. And we start to see earlier spring thaws, warmer winters. Our ice is not as thick as it used to be in the past. We're not getting as much snow as we used to.
Why does it matter if you don't have any snow or thick ice?
It takes the ice a little bit longer to get thick enough for us to walk on, to go out and put our nets under the ice. Those were one of the changes my dad talked about too. You know, where we go out and put our nets a little bit later than the past.
And what are you guys catching during the wintertime?
We set our nets out to catch seafish. It's a whitefish. It gets maybe about like 3.5 feet big. In spring and summer, seals come into the river. The way we hunt seals, we still practice an ancient method of hunting. We use a spear. It's made out of driftwood. We carve it into a long, narrow stick-like. At the end of the spear, we put feathers on there to, you know, help make it spin, fly. Some use ivory for their tip points. Nowadays, we start to use brass because they stay sharp. We throw the spear with a spear thrower, which is also made out of driftwood. When it's fall time, we go out into the ocean when it's starting to form ice. But when we go out into the ocean, we use guns and a harpoon. Harpoon, it's like the spear, but it's thicker. We don't use spear throwers for the harpoons. We just hold it in our hand. It can be dangerous for some who haven't really experienced hunting like that. We gain our skills and our knowledge at a young age when our dad or uncles, grandpas bring us out. They talk to us about, you know, the times, when to go out, what to look for, how to read the weather.
There's a lot of connection with St. Michael's, right?
Yeah, Stebbins and St. Michael's.
St. Michael's.
Mm-hmm. One of the relationships we have with Stebbins and St. Michael's is our annual potlatches that we have every year March.
And can you describe a little bit of like what goes on at a potlatch?
We have potlatches to celebrate. For instance, if a boy caught his first seal, or if a girl picked berries for the first time, their parents or their grandparents, they would introduce them at the potlatch, honoring them. Our first-time dancers, the ones that they present, some of them carry the names of those who have passed on, and they present them. After they introduce them, they pass out gifts to our guests who come from Stebbins, St. Michael, other nearby communities like Imanak, Alaknak, Nunam. And on the second night of the potlatch, they pass out native foods that they gather, like the seafish that they get as soon as the ice is thick enough to go on and set the nets under the river. We collect them and store them in our sheds. That's one of our trades that we do with Stebbins, trading our seafish with their reindeer.
Oh, neat. Wow.
But when we have our potlatches, it's a two-day event. Two days of dancing and singing.
Wow.
Some of our elders are starting to wonder how we're going to get to the potlatch. You know, they think about these changes.
Because
the sea ice is gone. When we travel up to St. Michael or Stebbins, we go out onto the Norton Sound on the coastline. And when tides come in, you know, that water pushes up and, you know, it affects our trail on the coastline. And where we have to cross the sloughs and creeks, you know, they're filled up with water. Or, like, if the ocean freezes out, we use the ocean trail. The ocean is not freezing as it used to. My dad and our elders, they would say, our grass growth depends on how much snow we have. The way I remembered my community in the past when I was young, it was beautiful. It was beautiful before we lost a lot of ground to erosion. So tall the grass used to be, we'd go run around and play in the grass, get lost in the grass. That's one thing I remembered, the grass being so tall, not like how it is today.
Perhaps I would have a couple of different experiences if I heard this a year ago versus now, because this last year I was able to travel to Kotlik with Ryan and meet Victor. To have gone to one of the mouths of the Yukon, I think was significant for me, being from a village further along, you know, particularly in Dene territory, Athabascan territory.
Does further along mean further downstream?
Further upstream.
Further.
Yeah, because Kotlik's right on the coast.
Okay.
Right? What really struck me is to hear that they still use their traditional hunting approach in terms of spearing seals, and then what it takes to maintain that. I guess the other thing that this story really is striking for me is just the last section of it, where Victor's talking about the changes in grass and tying that back to something that his father stressed that he needed to observe or to watch, you know, thinking about observations. And in the wholeness of observations, in the relationship between grass and then snowfall. Also, I think with that, the feelings we have about that. Elders wondering, you know, how are we going to get to some, to our traditional gathering places, and the grief that comes from when we see our land change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I just felt that yesterday, driving up, and I guess being in South Central Alaska the day before, a couple, you know, day, whatever, seeing the trees, you know, that have died from the beetle. And they're all over. I mean, it's that one species, and it's, you know, along the highway, that's a gorgeous area.
Yeah.
To travel from one region to the next in a very short period of time and see thinking about the totality of change.
Yeah.
We have a lot of feelings about what we're going through right now, and some of it is definitely grief.
The next conversation is between Arlo and Jessica. They talk about coming home to themselves and holding space for their own growth and encouraging the growth of others. When Arlo talks about diplomacy and the small moments between people, helping people hang in their discomfort zones, it got me thinking about how to have societal conversations that support growth and do it in a way that people can hear and speak. I recorded the following conversation titled Arctic Diplomacy and Native Movement that Kelsey Skonberg produced.
Hello, I'm Jessica Girard. I am 38 years old with my homie Arlo.
My name is Arlo Davis. I am 37 years old, and I am recording a story with my homie. I'm really curious what it's like for you here in Fairbanks as an East Coaster in a state that's kind of majority Native, working at an organization with Native in the title, Native Movement. What's that like for you?
Well, I just want to lay out Fairbanks a little bit. Native Movement is this dope organization run by some local folks. It was founded by Ine Begay Peter and Yvonne Peter, and Yvonne is a Gwich'in man, and Ine is a Navajo Dana Atam woman married into the Gwich'in Nation, and it basically is structured to fiscally sponsor other projects, and Fairbanks Climate Action Coalition is one of those projects. So I am the coordinator for the Fairbanks Climate Action Coalition. We formed it out of the necessity to raise the voices of those that were being quieted and cornered in the community that wanted to talk about climate change, that wanted to talk about some injustices, surrounding climate change, especially in northern and coastal villages in Alaska. Over time, we have molded into a really justice-based, principled coalition that works only with communities that ask us to be involved. We don't try to do a white savior thing and walk into a community and tell them what they need. We really work in solidarity with communities that have shared values, whether that's the faith community with the Quakers and the Catholics and the Presbyterians, or that's with villages and tribal entities that want to protect land resources. So there's a wide swath of who we work with, and not only is it strategic to do it that way because we really need to amplify our voices in Alaska, but also it's really important because it's changing the narrative of what Alaskans are to the people that live in the continental United States. People are now looking to Alaska being like, oh, not everyone wants oil and gas. Not everyone is so addicted.
But how do you, in the moment, speak to people at these meetings that are kind of coming from a whole bunch of different camps in ways that they can hear and that shift their approach a little bit, but not so much that it makes them uncomfortable?
I think I've been just the right amount oppressed and privileged to stand in the spot that I'm in, right? Like, I have a disability that drives my life, but also I have disability payments. So there's this weird juxtaposition of being oppressed and being the oppressor, right? I went to Iraq. I watched people get blown up on drones months at a time and cheered about it. I have to live with that every day, and I have to work from there to be a different person, recognizing that communities, specifically communities of color, frontline communities, have been trying to get people on board and tell them how bad things are for generations. And now there's this universal awakening happening. And I think it's really important that we don't waste time with everybody doing maybe necessarily a deep dive, that we do need to just address things as they come. We have been a socially unjust country since our inception, from the genocide to the slavery and on and on. And we keep pretending like it didn't happen and we can walk away from it. And if we don't talk about it, it won't make us uncomfortable. So I've just gotten really used to being uncomfortable. And then I have people like you in my life that ground me and center me and bring me back to this land and why we're doing this work. And I think I couldn't be me without people like you in my community.
So. And that goes both ways. Last summer when we went through the Howard Luke camp, and there was so much focus on indigenousness and hanging out with elders and having the kids run around everywhere. Leaving that camp, I felt legitimized as a native in ways that I had not felt before. And you and Eric were there for me when I was transitioning and building up my confidence. And so I've always really appreciated you and Eric giving me the space to just be myself. Because I'm native, but I'm also white, and have this environmental bent also, and recognize that the land is the basis for life.
I have this whole story about being in the military for 10 years and being totally militarized, and now some would call me a radical. And so that's a very long journey that some people won't want to see both parts of. Just like it seems to me when you're saying you're both Native and white, there's two parts of that story. You're not just this one thing or the other. And I think the more that we talk about our differences and our full stories and how they've informed where we're at, that is how we make the community stronger for whatever we face. Because if we're not reconnecting, we're not moving forward.
Everybody knows that, like, nations have international diplomats. And when it comes down to it, I think the real diplomacy, or the diplomacy that's more accessible to the people, or that has a maybe greater effect, is the diplomacy at the local level, in the small moments, at the little community meetings where folks like yourself have conversations with people and push people to step out of their comfort zones a little bit. And that's where it's at. And that's going on everywhere I think, at least I hope so.
Yeah, I think it's hard in Alaska. Sometimes it feels like we're all alone up here doing this work. But then when you go down to Baton Rouge and they're fighting a pipeline there, or you go to Wisconsin and they're talking about land rights for their deer there, you go to island nations that are talking about rights to the whale and that sacredness, it's just, again, another way that we're reconnecting. Before we go, I just want to take a minute and acknowledge the land that we're on, the Dene Athabascan land that we're on. But will you explain Trathi Adah before we go?
I was hanging out with Adrian a couple weeks ago when we drove out to Chena Hot Springs, and I found out from her that Troth is the Dene word for what we call mushroom back home in Eskimo, which is a root from a plant that is kind of like a long, skinny potato. And so she was saying Trathi Adah is the hill where you can find Troth. Or Mahru.
Anyway, Arlo, thanks for dragging me here. This has been really grounding, and I'm thankful that we got some time together.
Yeah, and I'm thankful you were up for doing this.
You mentioned the Alaska Voices theme and the part of building a better tomorrow. And the thing that I've always focused on in the part of the Alaska Voices motto or vision or whatever it's called is the building bridges. And I think there was a bit of the building bridges to a better tomorrow theme in this last conversation.
What struck me is really the significance of recognizing what each person can contribute and bring to some of the things that we're collectively facing, particularly in the area of climate and social change, you know, which both of them talked about. Whether it's your experience, as in Jessica's situation, her experience in her life, or whether it's that you may come from two different perspectives or more, if you come from a biracial or a multiracial background, in Arlo's case. And I think looking at what somebody can contribute to the collective efforts that we have together, some of that is really difficult. Looking at Jessica and realizing to stand in the space of saying and owning that she has been an oppressor and been oppressed, and being able to voice that and share it in the sense of making people uncomfortable, but also being uncomfortable and perhaps help people to think critically about what they're seeing or experiencing in a system that has, you know, been hellaciously off base in the experience, and building a bridge to understanding, as well as also being able to recognize when those people have a natural power, a natural way of being able to speak to various people that we need as a society.
What about the role of institutions?
Yeah, I think we're at a place not only as individuals, we're having to look at ourselves in the mirror in this country, right? Mm-hmm. But also our institutions. We need institutions like Native Movement that are willing to support efforts, whether it's efforts like coalitions or to say, how do we provide flexibility? Again, going back to the thought of, you know, major disruptions. I mean, clearly we can make change. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had to make just recently real abrupt change with COVID, right? So we know now we can do that, and many people are already talking about that. And then at the same time, we may have institutions where, you know, we have to make sure we have the proper piece of paperwork in, you know, a month ahead of time, when in people's work life, that may play out to make it very stressful. Many of our villages or communities may want to access our wonderful summer and also the fish or the game that we're reliant on. And we need institutions that can respond to that. We need leadership that are not scared to take a look at that. And it is definitely tied to an economic system that says, you know, here's your retirement. You need to be here so many hours a week, 40 hours a week to get this. And, you know, is that going to work for us in the future? And so I think that goes back to, again, that comment that Jessica made earlier about, from an Indigenous point of view, we've been saying this for a long time. You know, mainstream is like catching up and realizing it. Same thing with stories.
As we begin to wrap up our first season of Alaska Voices, we welcome your thoughts and input as we plan for our future. If you would like to share anything with us, please visit our About page on the Alaska Voices website.
Our next episode will revolve around the theme of upward battles, navigating hurdles, and overcoming barriers. With that, we will leave you with a short clip from Aurora and Joanna's conversation.
Once I found my role as this like peacemaker, it was like, okay, this is my role on the team. It's not so much science, it was more communication.
So did you take that role on yourself, just seeing a need for it, or was there ever a conversation?
Yeah, I just took on that role. It needed to happen. We needed to make sure that we saw each other and respected each other, but was pretty exhausting. There was one time sitting in the cook tent, people were getting ready for bed, and I was just sitting and writing in my journal. The other woman came in and started talking to me about some problems she was having with one of the people on our team. And I was, you know, listening and trying to help, you know, her figure out ways she could address this or conversations she could have or ways she could approach a conversation. We finished that conversation and then she left and went to bed. And then another field team member came into the tent and started, you know, expressing his frustrations to me about things he was experiencing. Then he left and then a third field team member came in.
Alaska Voices builds bridges by creating a space where community members, friends, policymakers, and scientists can share stories and place-based knowledge. This project was developed in partnership with StoryCorps and was funded by the Alaska Climate Adaptation Science Center. Additional funding was provided by the University of Alaska Fairbanks Chancellor through a generous gift from the Bentley Family Trust. Alaska Voices would not be possible without the help and efforts of an amazing group of people. Our producer and audio engineer is Kelsey Skomberg of Mossy Stone Media. Our podcast and outreach specialist is Michael DeLue. And our website designer is Carolyn Rosner.
We also want to thank the musicians whose songs we heard today. Arctic Evening by Marcel Dupriez. Another Version of You by Chris Zabriskie. Something to Save, Together We Are Stronger, and Resolution by Komiku. Dusty Chords by Raphael Archangel. Surreal Forest, Elk, and Underwater by Maiden. And Light Bowl by Mon Plaisir.
If you are interested in more conversations or information, please visit our website at alaskavoices.org.
For Alaska Voices, I'm Jesse Robertson.
And I'm Bob Bolton.